Just turn on that Charlie Brown smile. Give them that Charlie Brown grin. And some kids call you a loser, and you don't know where to begin. Just turn on that Charlie Brown smile and give them that Charlie Brown grin.
Tonight on a very special Hunnic March Madness, I'll be sitting down with creator and author Jason Youngbluth on his graphic novel, Weapon Brown. And then stick around for a very special segment of Do You Have the Time to Listen to Me, Jeremy Wine, as I discuss the whole Angelina Jolie, Apple Watch, and possibly removing director Gareth Edwards from the Godzilla franchise. But I'm not going to be a blockhead, because I'm going to inform you now that this podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers on several of tonight's topics, as well as some salty language. So, listener discretion is advised.
Shine your way. You can get that kite to fly. You can kick that football high. And you'll get that Valentine. Just wait and see.
March Madness continues. And what could be more maddening than to have good old Charlie Brown in the apocalypse? Well, tonight I'm going to be interviewing its author and creator, Jason Youngbluth, who came up with this great idea to put good old Charlie Brown in a post-World War III apocalyptic situation. And not only is Charlie Brown there, we've got Calvin, we've got Hobbes, we got Popeye, we got Beetle Bailey, and we even have a New York Times combo character that I have forgotten about over the years. We pretty much got everyone in this in a roundabout way, and even Garfield, no less. Well, we kind of have Garfield. He's kind of like a lizard worm thing, but he's there. So, Jason, I'm sure you've been asked this, and I try my best not to cookie cut, because this graphic novel was created, what, in 2002, I believe?
Oh, let's see. I began the story that ultimately evolved into the completed work around 2000, actually. That's when I started publishing a comic book called Deep Fried, and Weapon Brown was serialized in the first four issues. The original story arc, which was called A Peanut Scorn, began there. So that would have been taking it back to 2000.
Ah. Now, one of the other questions, of course, I had, when did you... Because I did read the preface for the graphic novel, that you'd never really got into the Peanuts comic strips so much, that you preferred the animated. Have you ever read a Peanuts comic strip since, or they just weren't your cup of tea?
Oh, well, I guess what I was saying with the preface there is that when I was into comic strips as a boy and a young man, Peanuts just never really grabbed me as far as the humor. Which is funny because I see, looking back at the earlier Peanuts work, I think it's much funnier in the beginning. I mean, it the humor really does hold up. And I think maybe Schultz was starting to lose a step. You know, by the time that I was reading it, I mean he'd been doing it for about 30 years at that point or longer. But I really enjoyed the animated specials. But it was just that the comic strip itself didn't really grab me on the level that other comics that I enjoyed did. But yeah, I was always a really big fan of the animated cartoons. Like a lot of people, I really cherish the holiday specials, arriving like clockwork, for their respective dates. And that was really the Peanuts that I enjoyed. The Charlie Brown that I enjoyed was the Charlie Brown of animation more so than the Charlie Brown of comic strips.
Interesting bit of trivia. And now I know I prepared some questions in advance, but there was one thing I forgot to put down. I don't know. Well, we're both, I guess, around the bad way, children of the 70s and 80s. I don't know if you're familiar with a movie called Gas, or We Have to Destroy the World in Order to Save It, but the opening kind of has Charlie Brown animation to it. And it's about kids who create a drug that kills anyone over the age of 21, so kids rule. And I guess because Charlie Brown, it's always, kid world. You rarely see the adults. You hear wah, wah, wah. but I saw the animation and it felt very Bill Melendez anime. And of course, around this time we had Mad Max. So my question, and of course The Day After Tomorrow, which came out I think in 1983. So I was curious, were you ever inspired by those movies to put Charlie Brown in that type of universe?
So I haven't heard of this movie, Gas, that you mentioned. It sounds interesting. I'd like to see it. The other movies you're talking about, the apocalypse movies, were definitely a big influence on me, you know, both from an entertainment point of view and then for influencing Webb and Brown. And I think the post-apocalyptic story that had the most inspiration, or that provided the most inspiration, was an audiobook I listened to when I was about 11 or 12, and that was Harlan Ellison reading his short story, A Boy and His Dog, which I've never actually read it in print, but the audiobook was great because he has a great voice, and it was a great story, had good sound and music. And, of course, the gag that of a lot of sci-fi movies, but especially of that book, which became a movie itself, is the idea of the lone apocalyptic warrior with his cuddly sidekick. You know, the Mad Max had a dog, Will Smith had a dog in I Am Legend, and there's, you know, so that motif recurs a lot. And that really inspired me because I was like, well, who's the ultimate boy and his dog? It's got to be Charlie Brown and Snoopy. So basically that was the real germ of the story, was listening to Harlan Ellison reading that book. And, you know, I tried to make a few nods to the story itself here and there in Weapon Brown.
You know, I have heard of A Boy and His Dog. That movie's on my Netflix queue, so I will definitely check that out. It makes sense now because you have Snoopy. And I guess that's the other question I would have, too, is that Snoopy is not Snoopy that we all know and love. He's a regular beagle. Mm-hmm. He's beefed up now. He's on steroids. Since A Boy and His Dog, if I have heard of, I think the boy can sort of talk to the dog telepathically. I think it was something mm-hmm. that effect. Were there any ideas to make Snoopy, like, classic Snoopy, or he just said, you know what, he's all grown up now, he's got to be, you know, a vicious beagle instead of being, you know.
That's funny. That, in its way, A Boy and His Dog, the Harlan Ellison version, is a bit more faithful to the idea of Peanuts, because the dog in A Boy and His Dog is actually not a very ferocious creature. It's actually kind of a small, mangy dog, but yes, it can speak and has telepathy. That's funny. You're the first person to ask me that. It never occurred to me to make Snoopy conversational in any way. He's basically Snoopy after a fashion, because I make a point of indicating that he's somehow intelligent, that he's actually smart enough to, like, fire a machine gun or to understand what Chuck is telling him to do, even though, you know, the nuances of language could, you know, even an intelligent dog can never pick up on what, you know, instructions really are. So I sort of gave the impression in my story that Snoop was semi-intelligent, maybe because he was genetically modified or something, but I never go to the full-on, you know, Snoopy is just a human being in fur, you know.
The other thing is, he eats Woodstock, of all creatures. So, but I've also noticed the illustrations, and they feel very, you know, Mad Magazine, very Cracked Magazine. Mm-hmm. If I've done the research, you've illustrated for Mad and Cracked?
Well, Cracked isn't a magazine anymore. Mad is the finally at the top of the heap and killed them all. But yes, I'm a regular cartoonist for Mad Magazine, and I've been doing stuff for them for, I'm losing track of time here, over 5 years, I think, at this point, mostly in the section of the magazine called The Strip Club. So, yeah, I do, you know, single panel and multi-panel cartoons for Mad. I wish Cracked was still a magazine. I've got a lot of rejected Mad material that would be great in a competitor magazine if one existed.
Yeah, and I believe you're also responsible for something called Scooby Don't.
Scooby Don't, that's me.
Do you want to elaborate a little bit more? Because I heard about it. It sounds interesting.
Sure. Well, that's one of the earliest cartoons I did for Mad, and I've only done like a handful of installments. But the premise is it's basically the Scooby-Doo gang. Originally, I was going to disguise them so that they would have parody names. But it turns out that Time Warner owns Scooby-Doo, this, and they own Matt, so I can get away with using their actual names and likenesses. And the premise is that you take one of the classic Scooby-Doo tropes, the first one being, you know, peeling the face off, the rubber mask off the villain at the end of the episode, and I would then turn it into something very gory. So in the first cartoon I did, they're going to peel the face. They take the guy's mask off, and they find out it's the butler or something. And then Freddy says he'll peel the butler's mask off and find out who the butler really is. And it turns out, of course, the butler is just the butler. So they end up ripping his face off. And I can't believe it's old. But so I've done several Scooby-Doo's where the premise always has to do with they're still in their schlocky universe, but then some sort of gory or a very adult twist takes place. I think my favorite one so far is they're driving down the Mystery Machine. They're driving down a road in the fog, and Freddy accidentally runs a guy over, and they all decide that the real culprit is something they call the Swamp Ghost, and the Swamp Ghost is something they pull out every time they make a mistake. So I think the final panel is Freddy saying, not that we've agreed it's the Swamp Ghost, let's get the kerosene.
Well, you never forget your first time. So what was the first comic book you ever read?
Well, the person who was with me my first time has actually said that she would like to forget that. So I don't think your theory holds up. But no, you're right. The comic, I'm sure I must have read, you know, Richie Riches and Caspers and other type of kid-friendly comics before the comic that sort of, you know, pivoted me onto the more superhero track. And that was a Green Lantern comic. And I remember it well because it seemed like it had a very surreal plot. Green Lantern apparently had this sort of pet starfish called from outer space called Itty. And Itty had died, and so they buried Itty in the backyard of, you know, someone's house. And then what seemed weird to me is that there's like a scene where they're Owen and some other characters are all sitting in the living room, like sort of sitting shiva for Itty, like talking, you know, reminiscing about this mindless animal that they just buried. And I thought, well, that's kind of weird, because even then I know that people don't really usually just sort of sit around and talk about their dead pet. And then, of course, Itty, meanwhile in the background, Itty has started to transform, death cannot kill Itty. He's now turning into like a sort of pile of weird dirt or something like that. So anyway, that comic just always stuck with me as being really weird and interesting at the same time, as, you know, it's just a superhero book. So that's really what I would consider my real... That's where comics really started to grab a hold of me, I think.
Is that what made you want to start to write and illustrate your own comics?
Possibly. I mean, there's an artistic streak that runs through my family, and actually, my great uncle Bob Donovan was another professional cartoonist. He's the only other person in my family who's ever been a professional artist, but he used to draw the Snuffy Smith comic strip for a few decades, as well as also did a short run on a comic strip of his own called Biddy and Bert, probably back in the 50s or maybe the early 60s. And I actually made sure to include Biddy and Bert getting away from the bad guys in the Weapon Brown graphic novel as kind of a nod to my uncle's own personal effort, unsuccessful, to make a name for himself. His own name for himself in comics, but he actually did pretty well as a cartoonist. So cartooning has always been an ambition of mine. I'm one of those people who just learned to draw and stuck with it when I was a kid, and I've really known since the fourth grade, literally, that cartooning was what I wanted to do for a living, and I just sort of stuck with it.
Now, the other thing is, when I'm going through the first couple pages of the graphic novel, something that really caught my eye, which I love, was the Treetop's Tattler and that Mill Closes Toast. Yeah. Now, when I was trying to do my research, because the Treetop's Tattler I thought was from the comic book strip Shoe. And
that's right.
Mill Closed, he's a character from the New York Times in the early 1900s, I believe, correct?
Yeah, he's one of the earliest comic strip characters.
So my question is, were you afraid? Because I don't think I've read a Shoe comic strip in years. And Milquoist, you really have to do your research for that one, like I did. Were you afraid that people for the 21st century were not going to be familiar with these type of references or characters?
Oh, not at all, not at all. The entire premise of Weapon Brown, I mean, initially it was just meant to be a one-off. It was that original story called the Peanut Scorn. It was just meant to goof on the idiosyncrasies of Peanuts, and that was where I was going to end it. But when I decided to expand the story and bring in other comic strip characters, I thought, well, let's go for broke. I'll bring in every conceivable comic strip character that still survives in living memory. And so I wanted to pay a nod to all the best remembered characters from the earliest days of comics, Milquetoast being one of them. And no, I was not afraid that people wouldn't get it because, well, first of all, I needed so many characters that it was almost inevitable that I would have to scrape up characters that have long since fallen out of memory. Just because every character in Weapon Brown, whether it's a speaking part or a background part, is some comic strip character from a pre-existing strip. So I needed the entire history of comics to be able to make Weapon Brown work. But no, I thought it would be fun for anyone who is either an aficionado of comics or who just wanted to, do what you did, research and find out, where I'm getting my ideas. I thought it would be a fun kind of scavenger hunt for them to try and piece together, where all these characters came from.
Now, we have to, of course, get back to good old Charlie Brown, which I love the panels of him doing what he does best, flying a kite. And he falls down, goes boom, and we see in his face, the shadowing over his face and him digging the nails in the dirt. How old is he supposed to be before the bombs drop? Because usually he's anywhere between 8 and 10. Here he looks like he's about 15 or 16. Now, I know you've been asked this a lot because people, of course, I'm sure have asked you, how do you not get sued? And I guess your loophole is you've made Charlie Brown look a little bit different and not, I guess, call him Charlie Brown, so you've found a way not to get sued on that part. But is he supposed to be, 21 and still trying to fly the kite? Or because he looks older for some reason.
That's up to you because, of course, he also has hair in that scene too. Because the idea behind that whole sequence was, everything about Weapon Brown that has to do specifically with the Peanuts characters was sort of meant to address a specific bit of the iconography and explain how it might have occurred in the context of World War III. So we see that when Charlie Brown begins, he's got hair. And yes, he does look a little older than he might have been in the comic. So you sort of decide for yourself, is this like a comic taking place, a few years after the strip ends, or is it just meant to be sort of an Elseworlds kind of thing? But then what we see is the bombs drop, and then the radiation is what makes him lose his hair. So, bingo. The first question is out of the way. Why is Charlie Brown bald? Well, he's bald because the world is full of nuclear radiation. And then it goes on from there. You find out, when he becomes an adult, I make jokes about, Peppermint Patty and Marcy being lesbians. I play up Lucy as kind of a psychotic a brainwasher, that sort of tweaks the whole psychiatrist angle. And so every joke in that is just meant to be a callback to something within the Charlie Brown strip. So you could see that not so much that. It's not so much that I'm explaining it, because of course by the time you see the Lucy joke about the psychiatry, it happens when they're adults. So it's not so much why was Lucy a psychiatrist when she was a child. It was more, here's a joke about Lucy being a psychiatrist, twisted to make sense in the post-apocalyptic world I'm creating. It's not so much that you should think of it as a complete adjunct to Charlie Brown. It's what it is. It's a parody. So everything about it is a parody of something within the original Charlie Brown strip.
And then something else too, because this is something that you really redefined with Lucy. That not only is she kind of reenacts that classic football scene where Charlie Brown pretty much kicks her in the head over and over again. I was kind of disappointed that she was taken out so soon, and I was kind of hoping she'd come back. But I guess, again, this is what fans have been wanting for years, to kick Lucy, but are there's like a team yay or nay, or how did fans take this about Charlie Brown, like, beating on her, and, like, why was she, you know, taken out so early in the story?
Oh, I see. Well, in the original story, it was only like a, you know, like a 24-page arc, and so I had to squeeze in all the Charlie Brown gags I could. So there was really no time to really linger on Lucy or on anyone, for that matter. So, but you know, ultimately, I thought she was an important enough character that I gave her a kind of a redemptive moment at the end of the story when Charlie Brown is fighting Calvin and Hobbes. Well, just Calvin at that point. Hobbes has been taken out, rematerializing from a puddle of sentient goo. So I did give her a chance to come back and play another part in the story. But yeah, there was just no way after the original story arc to bring her back in a logical fashion, because the Blockheads War storyline, which introduces all the other comic strip characters, takes place after the original story arc, and so there's really no way to give her any additional story at that point. But as far as what people think, I think people thought it was great. It was really the prime mover of the entire story, was getting to the moment where Charlie Brown kicks Lucy in the head for all those years.
Now, I also love the designs of the kite-eating train. This is the first time as well that we've ever seen an illustration of the Great Pumpkin, besides that Simpsons episode. But
that was the Grand Pumpkin.
The Grand Pumpkin. But this is the
they
first time.
More worried about being sued than I was.
But the kite-eating tree, I mean, for some reason this reminds me of EC Horror Comics. Mm-hmm. And was that supposed, especially with Garfield and Beetle Bailey, was that supposed to be a reference to those comics? Or, I mean, I'm assuming because it's the post-apocalypse, of course, Beetle Bailey, he's going to be a mutant beetle, and Garfield, yeah, he's going to be, because he's fat and lazy, let's make him into the sandworm creature. But yeah, the kiting tree, I thought, was pure genius because, you know, it's the kiting tree, and the Great Pumpkin, of course, is going to be a mutated pumpkin. But it does look like something out of the 50s and 60s EC comics. So I was just kind of wondering, like, was that some sort of nod, or that was just all pure coincidence?
I can't say that I was specifically influenced by anything from EC. It's kind of tough to make a man-eating tree that wouldn't look like something you've seen before. I'm specifically thinking of the tree in Poltergeist, you know, that tries to swallow the kid.
Yes.
I was probably thinking more of that than I was thinking of anything from EC Horror. But I think I was thinking of something specifically. There was something in those mouths, because the tree's got more than one mouth. And I'm not sure what I was referencing then. Maybe sort of the mouth from the alien in Alien. That's sort of my favorite horror mouth of all time, and I think that there's a more of a callback to that in the design of the gaping maw of the kite eating tree than there is any reference to EC Horror.
And of course, Blockheads War, Peanut Squirt. Is there any chance we're ever going to see this into like some sort of Telltale game? Because this would be a great choose your own adventure, like with the Walking Dead game and A Wolf Among Us.
Well, I've never actually heard of Telltale games before.
They're pretty much like a choose your own adventure. You can find them on the PC or the Xbox. Pretty much it's a motion comic, but you can choose. It's also part role playing game, so you can kind of like choose how you talk to the characters, and you can use the weapons. So it's part motion comic, part choose your own adventure. And they've taken the Walking Dead comic and they made it into a Telltale game. Wolf Among Us, they've made it into a Telltale game. So would there ever be a chance of making this into some sort of, like, choose-your-own-adventure PC game?
If anyone wants to contact me about that, I'll be glad to listen. It's not anything that I've made any plans for, but, you know, I'm open to any suggestion. A lot of people ask me, you know, will it be a Cartoon Network cartoon or something? In my wildest fantasy, I would love Weapon Brown to be the anchor story of a revised heavy metal type animated movie. That heavy metal was a big influence on me, with the movie at least. I wasn't so much a fan of the magazine, but the movie really made an impact on me, and I've always imagined that it'd be cool to make a contribution to whatever the next heavy metal is. Of course, that all happened before anime had become big. So, the Telltale Game, DC Game, series on Cartoon Network, Hollywood, if Jeremy Fine could find me, then certainly you can too.
How much creative control do you get at the end of the day when you write and draw and you're ready to submit? Like, are you ever worried about, well, this is okay, but you got to change this illustration a little bit or change this piece of dialogue? Like, who gets the final say with your work?
Just me. I'm the publisher, too, so I get 100% creative control.
Anything that ever gets put on the cutting room floor, like it just had to be edited out, then you ever wanted to do, like, a special edition of a book?
Oh, yeah. I tried to put in all the most important gags that covered all the most important strips. So, for instance, Beetle Bailey. I tried to make a joke about the most important elements of Beetle Bailey that people get. First of all, his name is Beetle, so I made a joke about Beetle being an actual Beetle. I made jokes about Miss Buxley and her breasts. That's a recurring joke within the strip. Garfield, that portraying him as a big slug. I tried to make sure that all the major strips that are still popular had a few gags written to exploit their idiosyncrasies. But there's always a few you leave out. I never did get to do, for instance, a gag about Billy or Jeffy from the Family Circus running around and leaving a dashed line. I had a thing set up for it, but that was one of the things draw and then cut it. I just didn't draw it. I didn't have time to squeeze in the joke about the dashed line, but I would have loved to have included that. And there's a few others jokes that I would still like to make, and I have been thinking that I might even do a follow-on one-shot of Weapon Brown short stories that would allow me to finish up not only the gags that I didn't get to include, but also answer some of the questions that about Chuck's backstory that never really got touched on, like how did he actually meet the red-haired girl? I intimated that there's there was a confrontation with Croc. By the way, a strip no one has ever heard of. This was in my newspaper in the Buffalo News. My entire childhood, no one I've met has heard of Croc, and yet he gets like a really large chunk of the story. So I guess those guys, Bret Hart and the other one, Bret Hart, I don't know if that's a wrestler, Hart and Parker, I think, are the ones who did Croc. But regardless, they owe me a bit of they owe me a thank you for giving Croc more exposure than it's gotten in decades. But anyway, that was part of Chuck's backstory. I'd like to do a story that fleshes that out a bit. And there's still a couple of the Charlie Brown holiday specials. I did three short stories based on the holiday specials, but there's a couple left to go, and I wouldn't mind a chance to do the Thanksgiving special, for instance, in short story form.
Now, of course, this is the big one. I'm sure you've been asked this a lot. The estate of Charles S. Schulz. Have any of them read the book, or are their thoughts on the book?
I do know that years ago, when the original Weapon Brown 48-page comic came out, that they ordered a couple copies of it for their archive. They being whoever runs the archive. So this is not unknown to the Schulz estate, and they seem to take it with good humor when they ordered it. I think I made a joke in my letter when I sent it with the copies to I hope they'll appreciate my heartfelt and warm tribute to Charles Schulz or something like that. And I think someone sent me back an email that said, haha. I've been doing it. Weapon Brown has been in the public eye since 2000, like I said. So if anyone had any complaints about it, I haven't heard of them.
Have you met any of your heroes over the years, like Jim Davis or...
That would be fun. I'd like to see. I'd like to meet Jim Davis and see what he thinks of what I did with Garfield. I actually did a joke in the comic where Jim Davis appears as a mutant chicken. So that would be fun. No, I don't actually know too many people in the comic strip business. But I think I should take the opportunity to start looking them up at the conventions I go to and get pictures of them holding Weapon Brown, just so I can. indemnify myself against lawsuits later if for no other reason.
So what are your future plans now? Any new books coming out? Anything else you'd like to promote?
Sure. Well, the very next thing I'll be doing is running a Kickstarter for a new deluxe format mini comic, we'll call it that. That's going to be called Peak. Originally, it was going to be Suicide Note number 3. Suicide Note was a mini comic that I did 2 issues of. But I thought this is a new comic that's going to premiere a new story featuring Clarissa, who's after Weapon Brown, Clarissa is probably my most popular creation. Also, she descends from Deep Fried. And I've been promising people a new Clarissa story for years now because Clarissa had a second life on the internet when people started scanning and posting the stories on ImageChans and so on. And so at long last, I'm going to be doing a new comic. It's going to be called Peak Number 1. And it'll have the new Clarissa story in it. So that Kickstarter will be launching probably less than a month now. I just finished up working on an animated commercial that'll promote it. Beyond that, I've got my own website, of course, whatisdeepfried.com. And there's a regular comic strip, the Deep Fried comic strip, that runs every week. I'm tentatively planning, that Weapon Brown short story collection, which I would like to get some other artists to illustrate. I think that would be fun. And then my next big project is something I've had in the on the back burner for a while. I was waiting for Weapon Brown and the Peak comic book to complete before getting ready for it. But there is a sort of superhero parody comic book concept that I'd like to see if I can get some publishers interested in, and I'm going to be pursuing the development of that later on this year.
Now, are you on Facebook or Twitter at all?
I'm on Facebook and Twitter and all. I Jason Youngbluth on Facebook. I think my handle is Death Ray or Weapon Brown on Twitter. You can find all the links on the homepage of my website, whatisdeepfried.com. DeviantArt as well, under Death Ray Graphics. I post there, I'm starting to post there regularly, so you can look me up there. The best way to find where I am is to go to whatisdeepfried.com and then follow the links from there. But yes, Twitter, Facebook, DeviantArt, Reddit, there's a subreddit for Deep Fried, and occasionally I post in the forums on Something Awful, which is my favorite website for promoting myself.
Well, my final question would be, and I know this was in the preface, what is the difference between a fucker and a fucker?
Oh, well, I think you just put your finger on it. I've never heard it pronounced as a fucker, but that was an idea I had halfway through the comic. I realized that I was spelling fucker 2 different ways, and I thought that this could be sort of future slang where the where when it's spelled F-U-K-K-E-R, that means that there's a you hit the K's a little bit harder, and it just means you're angrier. So calling someone a fucker is not too much of a slur in the future, but calling someone a fucker is a surefire bet that Chuck is about to rip your head off.
Well, Jason, thank you very much for joining us. We're going to take a quick break, and then I'm going to turn into Jeremy Wine as I'm going to be bitching about possibly Gareth Edwards is going to be removed from Godzilla 2, one could hope. So we'll take a quick break, and we'll be back after this.
Trash Video is your one-stop video shop in Sleazoid City.
Who the fuck is that dickhead?
I don't know.
We have the best rental stock of horror, cult, B-grade movies available on VHS.
Movies with corpse rape? Oh, let me get set.
Blu-ray? Fuck that shit! VHS!
Faces of Death is a family film.
Our professional, friendly, and knowledgeable staff are here to help you.
Hey, Roxy, after the shift, you wanna go watch a porno with me?
Shut up, Seth. I'm doing my nails.
So stop on by the store today.
I smell like video tapes in here.
TrashVideoPodcast.com.
Pixels in the Animation is the Geekcast Radio Network's video game cartoon review show. We are covering every episode of 9 different video game cartoons. Join TV's Mr. Neil and myself, TFG and Mike, as we trek through multiple Mario tunes, Zelda, Captain N, Mega Man, Sonic, and we are also driving through Donkey Kong Country. Pixels in the Animation is 100 episodes of video game cartoon goodness, so tune in to help us find the Pixels in the Animation, which you can find every Wednesday on iTunes and www.geekcastradio.com.
Jeremy Wine here, and moving on to the second half of this podcast. Originally, I was going to record separate podcasts on said topics, but you know what, with me and experimentation, so one of the things that, actually three of the things that have been trending on the internet web this week, especially on Facebook, there have been a lot of people who are posting petitions to have director Gareth Edwards removed as the director for Godzilla 2, Electric Monster Island Loop. Now, I saw Godzilla 14 in theaters twice. I reviewed it with Wyatt, and unfortunately, due to virus issues, the podcast was destroyed and lost forever, unless anybody has downloaded it and can send me a copy at honickfeedback@gmail.com, I'd appreciate it. But after the movie came and went, and read some reviews, and read some comments, and subscribed to some other podcasts, and everybody argued and say haters are going to be hating, and it was the greatest thing, and, you know, why are you bitching? Well, now I know why I can turn to Jeremy Wine for three of those reasons. And I understand why people have been complaining. The very first reason, I feel, is because the title of the movie is called Godzilla. Now, I understand with a lot of these monster movies, you have to have the humans for some reason, and they're the main core, and then all of a sudden the monster will come and either fight another monster, or the humans will fight the monster, or so on and so forth. But the problem is that I wanted to see Godzilla do something and not just stomp on toy buildings and toy cars as he's done in the past. I mean, it's a guilty pleasure for me. But for Godzilla 14, I was hoping for a little bit more destruction, finally. Like, there were people out there that bitched about not seeing a CGI Godzilla in the 21st century. Well, you finally get to see it, and he hardly does anything. That's a mistake. I love the opening for Godzilla 14. Something that a lot of people really didn't talk about, where it's kind of like that blink and you miss it. During the opening credits, there are warnings about the conspiracy theory of Godzilla, and they're being whited out, which I thought was interesting. So I thought there was going to be more to the mythology. There's the Japanese culture with their folklore and their deities, and, you know, it's interesting to read, and I was hoping that Godzilla would almost be like an equivalent to Gaia, Mother Earth, and because of nuclear holocaust, Gaia has been poisoned and polluted and turned into this creature. That's what I thought this movie would be about. Didn't happen. Like, you know, Earth is taking back what belongs to it because mankind is destroying it. That didn't happen. The Mudos, let's get into those. The something terrestrial thing. I forget what Mudo stands for, and I really don't care. Japan, Toho, knows how to make monsters. Now, they may be guys in suits, but at least those creatures, it's a plethora of monsters that are original at some extent. King Caesar, Megalon, you can laugh at him all you want to. You can't laugh at Ghidra, the three-headed monster. Mechagodzilla. I mean, there's so many. Why bring in new creatures and not make them as interesting and just make them like the Cloverfield monster, where they're really just a praying mantis in a way with a flat head? And then you throw in the Jurassic Park moments, especially when the humans are hiding from the creature and we get to see, okay, the creature's gigantic, a gun is not going to kill it, I get that, or no, a monster is the only way to destroy another monster, I get that, but when we see these shots of the human hiding from the creature to see how big the creature is and what the creature is doing when it's destroying something, been there, done that with Jurassic Park and so many other 50s and 60s B-movies, I was hoping for something a little bit more original. And these Mudos were just you know, you could have had Rodan, you just... And then, of course, let's get into the humans. I understand that Bryan Cranston, I mean, he's worth whatever you pay him, definitely. And I understand they only had him for, like, 2 weeks, and... But did they have to kill off the character? They could have put him in a coma. There's so much they could have done with Bryan Cranston. He could have been in a coma for the first act, and been in a coma throughout the second act, and woken up in the third act. And then for the sequel, it's kind of like with Transformers right now. You don't have to bring back this family, but whatever. And that's the other thing, too. Kick-Ass, or, you know, if that is the actor, which I really don't care about, he's a weapons expert that can disarm bombs. What does it have to do with Godzilla? Godzilla, I understand, was supposedly created by the bomb, but he spends most of the time, instead of getting back to San Francisco to save his wife and son, saving this other kid in Hawaii and trying to get back to San Francisco, you know, it's kind of like with Shia, I'm Not Famous Anymore with a Buff, where I just don't care about the human story. In any case, and even to have an Olsen twin in it, what does she have to do with anything? It just... I want simple. And you know what? I did see Gareth Edwards' Monsters, and it was about the humans and less about the monsters, and about Americans trying to, I think, leave Mexico to get back in the United States border after an alien invasion, and the humans are able to defeat the aliens, but the humans are still trying to get back into the States. I'm sorry, but the only person that I feel can save this franchise is Guillermo del Toro, who, of course, gave us Pacific Rim. At least we got some great monster fights, and again, I'm tired of all these monster fights in the water, in the dark, just, like, enough. If and when the sequel does come out, when I hope it does, I'm hoping a brand new director, because I don't want to see, and that's the other thing, too. You can justify all you want to, but a lot of people complained and said the same thing. To have Godzilla come in, cut his fight wing to one gigantic fight towards the end of the movie? No. Every other Toho movie that I know of had three or four fights in one gigantic big one, pardon the pun. They were always like snowflakes. No two were ever alike. So, in all honesty, I'm tired of this bullshit that you can't put in more fights in a Godzilla movie. And to me, that's where Gareth Edwards, as a director, you really are a death destroyer of this Godzilla franchise. And I can go on and on and on. I was never more bored. Now, my father went to see the second time with me. He also saw Pacific Rim after I had to see it the first time for a review, and we saw it the second time. He wanted to see Pacific Rim again, and I don't blame him. So, I'm all four, I'll sign that petition. I don't want Gareth Edwards anywhere near this franchise. They're just going to Jurassic Park. And, lo and behold, we got a new Jurassic Park, Jurassic World, coming out this year. So, that, as they say, is that. Now, the second thing I wanted to discuss was this whole issue with Angelina Jolie. I want to make something very clear, folks. I don't hate the woman. I don't detest the woman. I'm just not a fan of her work. And there are times that she can come off as being this person who always wants to be the center of attention. Don't believe me. During her so-called bad girl days, you can't see as I'm using finger quotes, woman was known for kissing her brother, and I mean kissing her brother, wearing vials of blood of her then-husband Billy Bob Thornton, having tats on, having tats removed. I mean, eventually she cleaned up her act and became this... You know, she goes to foreign countries and just adopts kids like she's going to a, you know, a puppy mill in a way. And I really hate to bring that up, but that's how it feels like because, you know, it's Angelina Jolie. And, of course, you know, now that she, you know, has cancer and she, you know, if I've read what I believe is true, you know, over the interweb, to have her ovaries and Fallopian tubes removed. Okay, yes, it is tragic that she has cancer. Anderson is running her family. I get all that. The way that it's coming off and the way it's being discussed, you know, she also is an A-list celebrity at this point, and she also has enough money to get the surgery. Now, I'm sure she doesn't even have to use an Aetna or a GHI or a, you know, United Healthcare insurance card. But what happens for all those who can't afford the surgery? She can go, I'm sure she's goes to a lot of charitable functions, I'm sure, you know, women's rights, I'm all for it. But what about all the women out there who cannot afford said surgery if they have ovarian cancer? I mean, hypothetically speaking, a lower middle class woman who probably is making less than $50,000 a year, would this surgery cover her? I mean, these are things that I think about. It's Angelina Jolie being brave, but you know what? I don't think she has to worry about ever wanting to literally, you know, give birth, because she's always adopting these kids from other countries. And I go around and around and around and around and around with this, but too many things that she does, she always just enjoys to draw so much attention to herself, especially that time at the Oscars where she's a presenter and she has a slit and she's showing off her leg, or, you know, to me, she's going to be three things. The woman who, you know, as I said, with the kissing the brother and, you know, the Billy Bob Thornton Vials of Blood, or, you know, stealing Brad Pitt away from Jennifer Aniston. Whether there is or isn't true, I mean, it's always been a big controversy, but that's what, you know, and everything has to be with her center of attention in a way. Maybe it's me, that's how I feel. And as for her directorial debut, Unbroken, read the book. I gotta be honest with you, I would not want to see the movie, because World War II survivor in a Japan POW camp. Very, very intense. If you thought the Germans were bad during World War II, if you have no idea, you do not even want to know what the Japanese did to the Americans when they were in POW camps. So, ambitious, yes, but for a directorial debut, Jolie, sorry, in hindsight, no. So, I mean, she's kind of on this pedestal where she'll only be part of movies that she'll want to go and see. That's kind of like George Clooney, like, he'll only be part of movies that he'll go and see. I personally am just, I have so many mixed feelings on what I've been reading and what's been stated on Facebook and on the interweb and everything. It was on NBC Nightly News the other night with this. But for me, she's always going to be this person that has to be the center of attention in a way. And again, my opinion, I live in the good old US of A, that's just the way that I think. But I'm going to make it, again, very, very clear. Do not hate her. Do not detest her. Just not a big fan, whether I do know her personally or not. But then a lot of people don't know me personally, and they make opinions, you know, judge me for where they know me. But I guess that's the joy of living in, you know, good old US of A. And finally, I'm saving the most idiotic for last. This whole thing right now with the Apple Watch. What do I think about it? It's Apple's newest toy. I mean, I remember watching the 80s movie version of Dragnet, where it was Tom Hanks who was watching TV on his watch, and it was a prop, and apparently, you know, could you find it, could you not? There were these Watchmen TVs. Well, now we are going to have the Apple. I'm sure there are smartwatches out there, but I think they can only hold a certain amount of, you know, storage. I'm sure they'll be able to do video, but I don't understand the point of it. Do we really need that small of a screen to watch TV on a watch, or music, or anything else? If it's a watch, fine, but the smartphones and the tablets, I guess I can understand, but a watch, no, I don't. I am working on my written reviews on geekcastradio.com called Shut Up and Take My Money. I am sure I'll be doing a written review in the not-too-distant future in regards to the Apple Watch, but for me, I think things are getting a little bit out of hand. Oh, and one more thing, how can I forget? The whole Walking Dead controversy right now. Well, I'm sorry for the delayed written review. We're doing some maintenance right now on geekcastradio.com with the publisher, so once I'm able to get back into the site, I will be working on my written review on the latest episode of Walking Dead. It's getting intense, people. Very, very intense with Rick versus Pete, with the W's written on the heads of the walkers and other victims. I think it is the wolves, the scavengers, which means that Negan is a coming, and I think that's why the 90-minute season finale, like I said, it's probably been extended for an extra half hour, but we'll get there when we get there. Gotham is coming back. I'll be doing some more written reviews on the last four episodes. Got a lot to say about that and write about it, so I will. In the meantime, you can find the show over at iTunes, Spreaker, and Spreaker. You can find the show at iTunes, Spreaker, and Stitcher. Hunnic Outcast, all one word. And also on the Harley Quinn, you know, logo. Not the old Mad Hatter logo that, as I said over and over again, changing RSS feeds until that one finally magically goes away. Check that out. But you'll see more episodes on the Harley Quinn one. Let's see what. Oh, of course, Twitter, Hunnic Outcast. Facebook.com, Hunnic Outcasts, which is, you know, it's Hunnic Outcast, but plural. And the Facebook group, Hunnic Outcasts. And, of course, you can find me partnered with GeekCastRadio.com, where you can find my written reviews of Gotham, the Harley Quinn comics. Pretty much just look me under my username, Hunnic Outcast, and you'll find all my written reviews, as well as my podcasts. And please check out all the other wonderful podcasts that are over in the main feed and the syndicated shows at GeekCastRadio.com, and all the ones that I subscribe to that are non-GeekCast related, please check out these shows: Arkham Sessions, the Batcave podcast, Books and Nachos, Now Playing podcast. Their donation series is coming up in a few weeks. I believe they're going to start off with Indiana Jones, followed by, I believe, Jurassic Park and the Goonies, but please go over to NowPlaying.com and check them out. I'm also now a freelance editor for some of their shows. Just, you know, just doing some freelance work, just, you know, looking to network and help out other podcasters any way that I can in my free time right now. And, of course, please check out Talking About My Generation by Doug Abel. He's also put up a brand new website, so, you know, please check that out as well. Dan and Jake at Classy, Punisher Body Count, Torgo's Pizzeria Podcast, Turtle Flakes, Disney Film Project, many, many more podcasts. Oh, yes, Real Ghost Stories Online, Anything Ghost, Continuous Play Podcast, and of course, as you've heard from my advertisements, Trash Radio Podcast. Please check out all these wonderful podcasts. And that's pretty much it for now. Hunnic March Madness will continue next week with two final episodes, but I will give away one very special one that hopefully will air on the 31st. Albert will be back. I finally fixed out all the technical aspects, as Albert and I will be discussing H.P. Lovecraft's From Beyond, which is pretty much reunited a couple of the actors from Reanimator. And I should also have another H.P. Lovecraft movie review sometime next week, cross fingers. If not, April is going to be a very interesting month. Right now, if everything goes well, for April 1st, I'll be doing some Joker comic book reviews for you. And season finale, if all goes well, you know the name, you know the fame. This December, King Kong retrospective. A lot of going-ons Thank you very much for downloading, listening. And I believe if I've done the calculations, I'm about 50 downloads away from the 1,000th download. And when that happens, I have a very special thank you podcast that will be the 1,000th. Well, I'm sure it'll be episode 55 for you, but it'll be the 1,000th download thank you podcast for everyone else. That you get the idea. And it's going to be a real swinging party. If you've seen the picture and you're getting the hints on the Facebook page, you know which movie I'll be reviewing. So, also, please feel free to leave me an email over at hunnickfeedback@gmail.com. So, until next time, Hunnick Outcast saying, it was all good and no grief. You're a grown man, CB. And for the second half, listeners, thank you for taking the time for listening to me whine.
Hello, geeks. Want a podcast that covers a vast array of topics with no rhyme or reason? Then check out Altered Geek Unlimited, where the topics fly more or less off the cuff. We cover media news, TV, our favorite geek products, and of course, your feedback. So get altered, get geeky with the Altered Geeks every Friday on the Geekcast Radio Network.
Are you looking for a weekly dose of gaming news and retro? Then check out Off the Cuff, available Fridays on Geekcast Radio Network from the producers of XRG. New name, same.
Now for a behind-the-scenes look at Geekcast Radio Network's newest show, Talking in Circles.
That was good. So, Chuck, Greg, what are you guys thinking for this week's show?
Well, Dan, how about we just talk about the things that we've read or watched this week?
We do reviews like that every week, Chuck. How about a game, like Fact or Fiction, or The Power of Names?
Those are great, and we're always coming up with new ideas for games. And how about some top fives? You know how I love my top fives.
What about tournament-style brackets, or sequel, reboot, and destroy, who will win in a fight, taking too far, crazy but true news, or...
Yes, it appears we have lots of things to work on.
Listen to Talking in Circles, taking timeless topics in new directions, every Tuesday on iTunes or GeekCastRadio.com, the Geekcast Radio Network.
Hey, Dan, who's the guy with the creepy voice?
I'm okay.
Did you see that? I almost died.
Phew. Good thing I didn't. That would have really stunk, wouldn't it? I mean, I just got here.
Hey, I'm still alive.
Thank God. I was so scared.
Listen, there's something I need to tell you. Because I'm a responsible husband.
Get
out of the city! There's giant monsters!
They're headed straight for the city and people are gonna die!
Leave now before it's too late!
You don't want me to wait for you to get here first?
For God's sake, stop talking and just go!
Oh, and take our son with you! Whatever you do, do not leave him with a stranger! That's just weird!
Okay, I will. Thank you for letting me know. Goodbye!
You're welcome!
The arrogance of man is thinking nature is in their control. And not the other way around. Let them fight.
Are you sure there's nothing we can do?
Let them fight.
Maybe nuke the creatures before they reach a major city?
Let them fight.
Maybe power down the facilities these monsters feed off of?
Let them fight.
Good man, Charlie Brown.
You can win a baseball game, Angelina.